Welcome back to Introduction to International Relations. In this lecture, we continue to move beyond the strict assumptions of neorealism, this time by focusing on domestic politics, thereby drawing on insights from classical liberalism and, to a lesser extent, constructivism. On the first slide, as always, I lay out the goals for this lecture. First, I'm going to discuss who wins and who loses when governments pursue various policies related to economic cooperation. Second, I'll derive from those arguments implications regarding what policies we should expect governments to enact. Finally, I'll present statistical analysis that evaluates some of those implications, those related to trade. Moving to the next slide, we start with the winners and losers from trade. First of all, removing or reducing barriers to trade tends to benefit all of us as consumers. It does this by lowering the prices of goods and services and increasing the quality thereof. These effects are both driven by the fact that there's more stuff to go around when states specialize in the production of goods and services in which they have a comparative advantage. One of the most basic laws of economics is that when the supply of something increases, holding constant the level of demand for it, the price tends to fall. So when there's more stuff to go around, which is another way of saying that supply increases, that allows us to buy it for less. The following thought experiment illustrates the point about quality. Suppose you're an important executive in one of the big pharmaceutical companies in the US, and your lab geeks are telling you that the early trials for a drug are quite promising. They're not ready to bring that drug to market, but they're pretty sure that another wave of trials will get you there. So they're asking for approval from you in that regard. This next set of trials is going to be a lot more expensive, though, because it's going to involve a lot more subjects. They're going to cost you $5 million. If you were only able to sell this drug within the US, there'd be no way that you'd make that money back. The disease this particular drug treats is too rare for that to be feasible. You'd have to charge a price no one would pay, given the small number of potential buyers. But if you could sell it to the world, you just might turn a profit. So in a world with relatively low barriers to trade, you approve that next wave of trials, and a life-saving drug may be discovered. With relatively high barriers to trade, though, those trials don't occur. And while the stakes are lower, we can tell a similar story about many leisure goods as well. Anytime research and development costs are large, relative to the per unit costs of production, the size of the market is going to play a huge role in determining whether the firm decides to pay those upfront costs. And when it comes to improving the quality of the products we buy, R&D can indeed be very important. So, we all win from trade in two respects. The stuff we buy is much cheaper and much better than it would be in a world with higher barriers to trade. Second, trade tends to benefit those who are employed by, own, or invest in sectors that produce goods or provide services in which their country has a comparative advantage. These sectors will not only remain in business even after barriers to trade are lowered, but will likely grow since demand for their goods and services will increase once they're no longer limited to selling to people in their own country. On the other hand, trade tends to hurt those who are employed by, own, or invest in any other sector, because those sectors are going to shrink or even disappear. Return to the example of rich republic and poorestan. If these two countries pursued self-sufficiency, there'd be people in Rich Republic who worked for companies producing E. But, as I mentioned in the lecture on trust problems, once R starts importing E from Poristan, those people will all lose their jobs. Eventually, some of them might find their way to the leisure sector, especially if Poristan is importing leisure goods from Rich Republic, and that sector is therefore booming. But either way, a lot of pain and suffering is going to be endured in the meantime. So what determines which sectors a country will have a comparative advantage in? There's a large literature on this in economics, and what I'm about to say doesn't do it justice, but one approach emphasizes the relative scarcity or abundance of factors of production, the stuff we use to make stuff. If a good requires a certain type of input, and your country has relatively little of that compared to other countries, odds are your country will not have a comparative advantage in its production. For example, a country that occupies an archipelago, that's a string of islands, will not have a comparative advantage in the production of agriculture because it won't have a lot of farmland. But that same nation may have a comparative advantage in fishing. Similarly, a nation with a highly educated workforce and lots of financial capital will have a comparative advantage in developing and utilizing new technologies, but not in producing things that require relatively unskilled labor. What does this tell us? That we might see lots of high-paying manufacturing jobs in countries like the US and the UK, in eras where there's relatively little economic cooperation between states. But those jobs will likely disappear when barriers to trade fall, since there's lots of people in other countries who can and will do the same work for a lot less. We should see those who live in the US, the UK, and other highly developed states benefiting from the dramatic increase in economic cooperation between states if they work in sectors that provide goods or services that require a highly educated workforce, but we should see wage stagnation or chronic unemployment in all other sectors. On the other hand, we should see people in less developed states benefiting fairly broadly. That is, we should see the rich in rich parts of the world become even richer, while the middle and working classes in those countries suffer. But because that suffering is mostly caused by jobs being outsourced, we should see broad swaths of the population in developing countries, particularly those that are integrated into the world economy, escaping poverty. And that's pretty much what's been happening. Turn to the next slide. The graph on the left shows the percentage change in income for people at different rungs of the economic ladder from 1988 to 2008. That is, the y-axis tells us how much people at a certain position saw their incomes increase, or in some cases decrease, over that 20-year period, while the x-axis varies the initial level of income relative to everyone else in the world. So at the far left, we have the poorest people in the world. At the far right, the richest. And what do we see here? Well, incomes went up quite dramatically for everyone from the 5th percentile to the 65th percentile of the global income distribution. That's consistent with the claim that lowering barriers to trade, as many countries did in the 1990s, benefits broad swaths of the developing world. This graph doesn't tell us where those gains are occurring geographically, but it shouldn't surprise you to hear that in 1988, and today for that matter, people at the lower end of the income distribution globally mostly lived in developing countries. So the first thing to take away from this graph is that more than half of the world's population saw a big increase in income when barriers to trade fell and the modern period of globalization hit full swing. However, between the 65th and 95th percentiles, people either gained a lot less or even suffered an actual decrease in income. Most of the people occupying this region of the global distribution lived in the developed world, but fall below the 65th percentile within their countries. Again, the graph on the left can't tell us where people live, but the average household income for working-class families in the US and the UK in 1988 was considerably greater than that of almost anyone in the developing world. That's largely true to this day, though not to the extent that it was in 1988. Put simply, people at the lower end of the scale in wealthy countries are actually in the upper third of the distribution globally. So while the graph only tells us that this period, a period in which trade expanded dramatically, wasn't so good for people between the 65th and 95th percentiles, given what we know about how income is distributed globally, that lines up well with the claim that trade isn't going to benefit most people in the developed world the way it will those in the developing world, because, in many cases, their jobs are being shipped overseas. Finally, the graph is telling us that the top 5% of the distribution, which includes people in lots of countries, but mostly represents the upper classes of developed countries, saw their incomes increase nearly as much as the lower part of the distribution. So when you hear people say that the rich get richer while the poor get poorer, well, that's sort of true if you only look at developed countries. But if you take a broader view, considering what's happening across the world, the second half of that breaks down. What we've really seen is the rich getting richer, most of the poor also getting richer, except for the very poorest, who saw basically no change at all, and the middle class stagnating. That's nowhere near as catchy, but it's more accurate. Put simply, inequality within countries, particularly developed countries, has gone up, and that's largely, though not exclusively, due to increased trade. But we've also seen inequality between countries decrease, again, mostly due to trade. The second graph helps to illustrate this. Between 1970 and 2006, the extreme poverty rate has fallen dramatically. For the poorest of the poor, life has gotten a lot better thanks to economic globalization. Yes, that's a simplification. There have also been a lot of deadly wars in this period, mostly occurring in poor countries. And globalization itself has done a lot of harm to some in the developing world. But, to a first approximation, we've seen exactly what we'd expect to see according to the theoretical arguments I've laid out over the last few decades. We've seen a dramatic increase in the affordability of most consumer goods, the development of incredible new technologies, and a dramatic increase in income for those employed in the right sectors in the right countries. But the picture hasn't been so pretty for those who were once employed in less competitive sectors. From 1990 to 2008, for example, roughly 2% of job growth in the US occurred in tradable sectors. That is, almost all of the jobs created in that period involved doing things that couldn't be done by someone in China or India. Because if it could be, it probably was. In other words, I'm telling you that trade is largely to blame for the stagnation of the middle class here in the UK and throughout the developed world. But if you tell me that you dislike trade because all it does is help the rich get richer on the backs of everyone else, that it's your concern for the poor that leads you to object to globalization, I'm going to have to tell you that you're either ignorant or insincere. Because the same process that ruined the lives of many Brits and Americans and Europeans and others who are pretty well off by global standards has lifted billions of people, that's billion with a B, out of extreme poverty. For every laid-off factory worker you can find here, there are two or three people in China and India who were able to escape extreme poverty, able to leave the farm and move to the city. I'm not saying you ought to care more about them than the suffering you see around you in your own community, nor that it would be inappropriate to argue that the British government has an obligation to put the interests of Britons first. But those arguments aren't about inequality or doing what's best for the poor. That's nationalism talking, plain and simple, which you might be okay with, and that's fine. But don't pretend that you're a champion of the poor when you advocate rolling back policies that brought huge benefits to the bottom two-thirds of the global income distribution. Let's now move on to the winners and losers from inflation. We need to understand this if we're to understand who wins and who loses from the adoption of fixed exchange rates and common currencies. Recall that I said earlier that fixed exchange rates promote cooperation, but they also generally require governments to give up control over monetary policy, and that that's important because monetary policy affects inflation. There's some disagreement among economists about precisely what monetary policy can achieve, when, and why. But one thing that's quite widely accepted is that when a government, or in most cases its central bank, increases the rate of growth in the supply of its currency, that tends to increase inflation. When the monetary supply increases more slowly, that tends to promote lower rates of inflation, or potentially even causes deflation. How exactly that works is a bit complicated, but it's not important for our purposes anyway. Just know that governments can influence inflation so long as they have control of monetary policy. And that matters because sometimes governments want to lower inflation, but other times, believe it or not, they actually want to raise it. Why is that? Well, because inflation isn't what you think it is. You're probably used to thinking of it as bad, bad, bad. That's certainly how the media talks about it. But it actually creates both winners and losers. The best way to think about it is that inflation erodes the value of written contracts. It's a bit more complicated than that, but if you understand that effect, you'll understand why some people worry about it a lot more than others, and why some political parties worry about it more than others. As I say on the fourth slide, inflation acts as a transfer from net creditors to net debtors. Creditors are those to whom money is owed, which doesn't just include bankers. If you have money in a bank account, one that accrues interest anyway, congratulations, you are someone to whom money is owed. The bank doesn't put your deposits in a vault and keep them there until you withdraw them. They loan your money out to other people, with a promise to give it back to you when you ask for it, plus a little something extra. That extra comes from people who took out loans from the bank and repaid them with interest. So in a way, they're paying you. Yes, the bank takes a little something off the top. Okay, more than a little something. But for all the complication of the middleman, and the fact that you'll never meet most of the people who borrow your money, it's still true that you're a creditor so long as you've got a positive balance on a bank account that pays interest. And if that balance exceeds the amount of debt you hold on your credit cards, car loans, mortgage, and whatever else, then you're a net creditor, and you're harmed by inflation. But if you're a net debtor, if you've taken out loans or carry a balance on your credit card and haven't got much money in the bank, inflation benefits you. Suppose a few years out of uni, you earn £60,000 a year, or the equivalent in some other currency, and you take out a loan for £200,000 to buy a house. Then, over the course of the next year, the rate of inflation increases from nothing to 5%. Let's assume, for the sake of argument, that your salary keeps pace with inflation. And I'll try to convince you in a few minutes that this is often the case, though your intuition might tell you that greedy employers would never let that happen. That would mean you'd be earning £63,000 next year. When you go to buy groceries, you'll find that everything is 5% more expensive, but you're earning 5% more than you used to, so your actual ability to put food on the table hasn't changed at all. Yes, this is a simplification. It's rarely so straightforward in reality. But on average, it more or less works out this way. Why then does inflation matter at all? Aside from the fact that some things change in price more so than others, and your salary doesn't always catch up right away? Well, the main impact of inflation, as I've said, is that it erodes the value of written contracts. Your mortgage was for £200,000 back when a pound went a little further. Now, it's still for £200,000, less however much you manage to pay off in a year. But a pound doesn't mean what it used to. For all intents and purposes, 5% of your debt was forgiven, because the bank doesn't get to increase the amount that you owe. Can't they increase your interest rate? Well, yeah, they can, potentially. It depends on the terms of the loan. Again, it's a bit more complicated than I'm describing, but those complications only alter the magnitudes of the effects that I'm talking about, not their direction. It's still true that inflation is bad news for banks and anyone who has more money saved up than they've borrowed and have yet to repay, but good news for those who owe money to banks or other institutions. I mentioned above that salaries tend to keep up with inflation. I should say that that's only true after a lag. That rarely happens straight away, which is admittedly another reason to fear inflation, even if you're a net debtor. But, at least in the medium term, employers really do adjust for inflation. There's two points worth making here. One is theoretical and has to do with the incentives facing employers. The other is empirical, in case you're not persuaded by the former. First, consider that anyone who is unhappy with their job can always quit and go wait on tables. When people tip, they generally do so in relation to the size of the bill. They give a percentage. So if the price of food goes up, the average tip will go up. Thus, those who wait on tables make more money in absolute terms when there's inflation. Not by enough to actually be doing better, but that's not what I'm trying to argue. I'm just saying that when there's inflation, people tend to get paid more and buy more or less the same amount. And the mechanism is straightforward in the case of people who earn tips. And if those were the only jobs for which this was true, then even if inflation was only 2 or 3% a year, after a couple of decades, everyone would want to wait on tables, and no one would be willing to work any other job. But of course, that's not what we see. Whether you're willing to accept my implicit assumption that employers are aware that if they don't pay their employees enough, they're likely to find that sooner or later, no one will work for them, and that this keeps their greed in check, you can just trust your eyes. Do you see a world in which waiting on tables is considered the best job in the world? No. In fact, there are very few jobs with an average salary today that isn't much higher than it was a century ago. And in many cases, it makes no sense to say that's because people today are better at those jobs than they were 100 years ago. So, who wins and who loses when governments give up control of their monetary policy, either by adopting a fixed exchange rate or joining a common currency? The answer to that depends in part on what the government would be expected to do if it retained control of monetary policy, as well as what's expected to happen under the fixed exchange rate or common currency. Inflation or deflation can occur even when a country has a fixed exchange rate, depending on the rate of expansion and the supply of whatever the currency's value is fixed to. But we don't need to get into that. Let's focus more on the implications for countries with a common currency, since that's more relevant today. When countries adopt a common currency, such as the euro, their governments transfer control of monetary policy to either another government or a supranational authority like the European Central Bank. If the new authority is expected to allow inflation, that's bad news for net creditors, who tend to be wealthy, and good news for net debtors, who tend to be poorer. Adopting a common currency has some other impacts as well. As it says on the slide, it affects purchasing power and a country's ability to borrow. That is, if you live in a country with a relatively weak currency, and then one day your government joins a common currency, one that's relatively strong, your ability to buy stuff domestically won't necessarily change much, at least not in the very short run. But your ability to buy anything that was imported will. Or, in the other direction, if your country has an independent currency that's relatively strong, joining a common currency would decrease your ability to buy stuff that was made elsewhere. For example, the pound sterling has generally been stronger than the euro. So if the UK were to adopt the euro, as most of the rest of the EU has, that would make it harder for Britons to buy anything not made in the UK. But for some of the countries that adopted the euro, such as Greece, the opposite was true. And we can tell a similar story about borrowing. Suppose Greece had abandoned the euro as a result of its recent financial trouble. If they'd gone back to the drachma, they'd have a hard time borrowing money again. Investors would be afraid that the next time they got into trouble, they tried to inflate away their debt. That is, just as inflation erodes the debt of individuals who've taken out loans from banks, it also chips away at the national debt. If Greece returned to the drachma and had control over its monetary policy, it could choose to print money, and that would make it easier to pay back their loans, but they'd be paying it back with drachmas that wouldn't be worth much. Investors can anticipate that, though, so they would only loan Greece money if they were afforded generous interest rates, which Greece wouldn't want to offer unless they really needed the money. So their ability to borrow would be limited. Adopting the euro allowed Greece to borrow at more attractive rates because investors weren't as worried about inflation being used to cheat them out of what they were owed. The UK doesn't need to worry much about that. It's already able to borrow at pretty low rates. But for some countries, giving up the ability to generate inflation actually helps them out quite a bit because it reassures investors that they'll get their money back and it'll be worth what they expect it to be when they do. Now let's talk about the economic winners and losers from migration. As I acknowledged in the lecture on foregone benefits, immigration is not purely an economic issue. There are cultural implications, implications for law enforcement, for politics, etc. But we're going to set those aside for now and focus on the ways in which what we've said about trade can be applied here. First of all, lower barriers to immigration create benefits for all of us by ensuring that there's more stuff to go around in exactly the same way that trade does. However, anyone who works in the same sector that the immigrants do will be made worse off when barriers to immigration are lowered. There are only so many people who fall into that category in a country like the UK, but yes, those people are hurt. Again, immigration is not purely an economic issue, but I think people badly misunderstand the economics of it, so that's worth stressing. Even the most pessimistic studies, like those commissioned by opponents of immigration, find net benefits. In most cases, immigrants are taking jobs Britons don't want. To sum up, all of the forms of economic cooperation we've discussed, lowering barriers to trade, adopting fixed exchange rates or joining a common currency, and lowering barriers to immigration, benefit some while harming others. The benefits in each case are widely believed to exceed the costs in aggregate, but politicians don't necessarily do what's best for the country overall. They do what they need to do to stay in power. And if one group speaks louder than the other, it's likely their interests that will drive policy. So turn now to the seventh slide, where we get more into that. All leaders have to keep some group of people happy. That's true even of dictators, though they certainly don't have to keep the same number of people happy. The group of people whose support is absolutely necessary to continued rule is known as the minimal winning coalition. In democracies, that's roughly half the adult population. In a military junta, it's the generals and probably the colonels. But I'm going to focus on democracies because I think we understand what goes on inside them a bit better. Trade policy and exchange rates aren't generally top concerns for voters. Economic growth, unemployment, inflation, and immigration are. Voters like growth, which trade and immigration push up, but don't like seeing their jobs disappear. Wealthier voters worry a lot about inflation, which governments can't combat if they've adopted fixed exchange rates or joined common currencies. And immigration tends to be unpopular with broad swaths of the electorate for a variety of reasons. Opposition tends to increase when there's more anxiety about the state of the economy, but it's not just that. There's obviously a cultural component as well as concerns about security. So, how do governments balance demands for growth on the one hand and opposition to many of the policies that generate it? Well, so far, we've been talking about cooperation in a very crude way. In all of the theoretical models, states had the choice to cooperate or not. They couldn't block imports of just certain goods while allowing imports of other things, or hand out lots of worker visas in some areas while tightening overall immigration restrictions. But in the real world, governments can be more selective, and often are. In light of that, the preceding discussion would lead us to expect rich democracies to generally favor low barriers to trade, but for them to be selective about it. They should push hardest for everyone to lower barriers to the stuff they're good at producing, such as high-tech manufactured goods, while doing whatever they can to protect jobs in sectors where they lack a comparative advantage, say, by providing huge subsidies to agriculture. Note that while manufacturing jobs have largely disappeared from the US and the UK, manufacturing output has actually continued to grow. That is, machines now do a lot of what people once did. Don't let the fact that the US and the UK, like other advanced economies, have undergone a process known as deindustrialization fool you into thinking they no longer have a comparative advantage in the production of manufactured goods. They do. Because of the political importance of inflation, we should see rich democracies be very reluctant to adopt fixed exchange rates or join common currencies, unless their national currency is weak and they're unable to borrow at decent interest rates. For countries that retain control of monetary policy, we should see inflation go up when parties of the left, which draw support from people who tend to be net debtors, are in power, but go down when parties of the right, which draw support from people who tend to be net creditors, are in power. Finally, when it comes to immigration, we should see governments making it easy for people who've already lined up jobs in competitive sectors to get work visas, while restricting immigration everywhere else as much as possible. As it turns out, all of these things have been investigated, and there's at least some evidence in support of every one of them. I'm only going to present evidence related to the first three, though, in the interests of time. On the ninth slide, I discussed the data used by a recent study. It looked at the trade relations of all countries from 1990 to 2000. There are actually two dependent variables this time, one each for two different sets of analysis. The first is the dollar amount of imports a country had in agriculture. The second, the same thing, but for manufacturing. The one independent variable of interest is membership in the WTO, with the expectation being that the WTO promotes the interests of rich democracies like the US, the UK, and Europe, as those countries control the majority of votes within the institution. So what we're expecting to see is that countries that belong to the WTO imported more than those that did not when it comes to manufacturing, but that the same pattern is not evident when it comes to agriculture. The last slide summarizes the results from the study. As you can see, the authors found exactly what we'd expect them to find. There is a positive, statistically significant pattern of association between WTO membership and manufacturing imports, which rich democracies have a comparative advantage in, but a negative and statistically significant pattern between WTO membership and agricultural imports, which they do not. Now, whenever we're talking about patterns of association that were identified through statistical analysis of non-experimental data, we have to be careful not to overinterpret the results. The fact that the authors found a negative pattern of association between WTO membership and agricultural imports does not, by itself, prove that the WTO reduced trade in that sector. Nor does the positive association between WTO membership and imports of manufactured goods tell us for sure that the WTO is causally responsible for that. But it's not obvious what Zed might be here, and we do have a clear sense of what the mechanism would be by which X exerted a causal impact on Y. So while I don't want to say that we know for a fact what's going on here, it's certainly consistent with the arguments I laid out in this lecture. It looks like rich democracies are using this international institution that was designed to promote trade rather selectively, to promote trade in ways that advance the interests of their consumers and exporters, while blocking trade in areas where they lack a comparative advantage. That's not necessarily good economics, but it's probably good politics.